Welcome back, everybody, to the Drink and Learn podcast. I am drinks historian Elizabeth Pierce.
And I'm bartender Abigail Gallo.
And we are both very excited to continue with our spirits theme, especially because we're going to be talking about two of our favorites today, and that's whiskey.
Yes.
With an E.
Whiskey, right? With an E, yes. Specifically, Scotch and Irish whiskey.
Yes. And as the Scots would say, and whiskey with no E, as God intended for it to be spelled or something.
Oh, man, those Scots.
Yes. So whiskey with an E and whiskey with no E, because whiskey with an E is how they spell it in Ireland, also America, but that's a different episode. And with no E in Scotland. Abigail, do you remember which you had first? Irish whiskey or Scotch in your life?
It had to be Irish whiskey. It must have been. Well, because I have family in Ireland and I've been obsessed with all things Irish since I was 8 years old, and we went to visit our Irish family for the first time, and I thought they were the nicest, kindest, most amazing human beings I had ever met, and I wanted to be just like them. So my Irish gran, as I call her, my cousin Bridget, introduced me to Paddy's Irish whiskey at a relatively young age, I'd say.
I mean, can you ever really be too young? Like, rub it on your gums when you're teething, right?
I'm sure my mother did.
Better.
I'm sure my mother did. She claims she used rum, but I don't know. I have a taste for whiskey. It might have been whiskey.
So we're going to do our best to explain to folks who want to know what makes Irish whiskey Irish and Scotch whiskey Scotch, besides being made in their respective countries. It's kind of the goal of this season is to demystify all the spirits that people have been hearing about and maybe even tasted but not really understood. So I'm going to give a super brief actually, it's not even going to be an overview. I'm just going to tell you some fun things that I learned about Scotch and Irish whiskey. First of all, no matter what a Scot or an Irish person tells you, no one can say for sure who made whiskey first. A woman who wrote a book called 99 Drams, she said, ask any academic and they will shrug their shoulders and say, who the hell knows? Nobody was really keeping very good records back then. So it's definitely around in the like thousands, 1100s. And the first written record of whiskey with no E appears in an Irish chronicle, the Annals of Clonmacnoise. And what was funny about it is that it's they write down that a head of a clan died after taking a surfeit of aqua vitae. So basically, somebody drank too much whiskey and they died, which is a terrible way to have, like, that's kind of sad. That's the first written record of whiskey, but it's also kind of funny. And up until
there are
that
worse
point,
ways to go at the time. I mean, there's plague, there's broadswords everywhere. Come on.
That's
if you're
gonna
true. Go.
Right. All the diseases and like wounds festering and getting gangrenous. Yeah, I guess whiskey's the way to go. So, by the late 1400s, King James of Scotland grants a large amount of malt to a friar to make aqua vitae, we should talk about why it's called whiskey. Mm-hmm. Because it was uscabe
in Gaelic,
uscabe,
which means water of life.
Right. And that's what aqua vitae also means, mm-hmm, in Latin. And so you see this word aqua vitae come up in like oldie timey stuff. So King James gives a friar this malt to make it, and so that's who's making it. Just like the monks were brewing the beer, the monks were also making whiskey until Henry VIII dissolves the monasteries, at least in England. And now a large number of independent monks have to figure out how to way up to make a living and take the skill set you already have, Mr. Monk, and start making some whiskey. So now we're up into the 1700s, and it's like becoming a thing. for people to make whiskey. In particular, there's this tax. It's always a tax. The malt tax of 1725, and a lot of distilleries go underground, leading to the production of moonshine. And that's where the word moonshine comes from, because you're making it by the light of the moon. And then eventually Scotland and England, Scotland and England are now connected and ruled by one king. They realize this is dumb. We should just legalize this this industry and start making some money from it. And in the 1800s, that's when Scotch emerges as this spirit that's also a big source of revenue. And then it will eventually move out into the world. So there's your Scotch. And the Irish story pretty much closely follows it with the emergence of what we see now as like distillery, as the modern distillery coming about like in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But Irish whiskey is way, way more popular than Scotch. In fact, there's more Irish whiskey sold in Scotland than Scotch up until the 1880s. But then everything starts to go to hell in with Irish whiskey. And before we started recording, Abigail and I were talking about this. And I think it's a really fascinating window. It's the thing that I most love about using liquor to talk about history and culture and time and place, because the whiskey story in Ireland is so representative of lots of other global forces. And the one that makes the biggest change in that story is the column still. So Abigail, why don't you elucidate... Is that the word I want to elucidate our listeners with pot still versus column still and why that matters?
Yeah. Well, let's go back momentarily to where we got the ability to distill. And distillation was created in the Middle Ages by the Moors. And they didn't drink, but they used this to make medicine. And they used it to make perfume, this distillate.
Right. And if you want to know a little bit more about this, you should go listen to the brandy episode, because we talk a little bit about that too. Mm-hmm. And then you can learn about brandy.
So those early stills were sometimes called Arab stills, because mm-hmm. that's the area it came from. And it has those kind of gooseneck tops for distillate. And the pots are on the bottom, and you put the mash on the bottom, and it boils and goes up through this long gooseneck, and the distillate kind of drips out of the top after been vaporized.
And mash is the recipe. So
is the recipe. It's basically the beer. Right. It's the grain. Yeah. It's the mash. It's the beer that they put in these pots and then boil until you get the distillate, because all distillate, when it begins, is basically a beer. You're making a beer or a wine if you're using fruit. Mm-hmm. So so that is the monks, and they go to study in what is now Italy, but at the time the Holy Roman Empire, which is a close trading partner with the Middle East, and they learn this skill of distilling, and they bring that with them when they continue their migration across the continent to spread the word of Christ, as it were, and in turn end up spreading this beautiful form of distillation, which is a pot still. Column still distillation is you put the batch in at the top, it drops down the column, and it gets vaporized on the bottom, and it goes up and hits different plates that are in the column and then runs off, and that's how you get the distillate. And the main difference between those two is that the copper pot still is a single distillation, single batch. You have to do a batch, boil it off, and then it's done. With a column still, sometimes called a continuous still, you could continually distill. So you can you can create more whiskey and run it all the time and thus produce more whiskey to sell. It was actually an Irishman, Aeneas Coffey, who patented this kind of column still design in 1830. And he was building upon the design of a Scotsman, Robert Stein. Now, let me just make a note to say that even though Aeneas Coffey is identified as an Irishman and Robert Stein is identified as a Scotsman, at this time, 1930, they are both subjects of the United Kingdom. Because Ireland is not a country on its own until 1922. The Coffey design transformed whiskey production all around the world. Companies in Kentucky, companies in Germany, companies in Italy, these companies are known for making the best stills in the world, and they still use this same design that the Coffey still that was designed in 1830. I love when you visit a distillery and you look at some of these old stills, you'll see the dates on them. They're still working perfectly well, and they were built like 200 years ago. It's amazing. It's amazing the quality that is put in this. And, you know, they really care about these. Every still has its own little ticks to it. The master distiller knows that, you know, because it's got this dent, it makes a slightly different flavor distillate. There's all these different styles and designs. You can go and see four different kinds of pot stills at a Scottish distillery. And some, you know, master distillers have them designed differently because they feel like the distillate will come out a better way. So that is the single pot still of Irish whiskey tends to be a combination of different kinds of barley as well. That also changes the flavor. So even if they are using a pot still, just like they are in Scotland, the flavors can be different because they use a combination of malted barley and unmalted barley. They also will blend in continuous still whiskey made from corn and made from barley as well. So the flavors start to taste different in the different stills, not only depending on what you put in, but there tends to be more of a funk kind of associated with a pot still because you're doing a single batch at a time. Whereas a continuous still is just because you can run it continuously, the flavor is a little bit more consistent.
And I'm guessing that every pot still, because you're doing different, each one is its own like batch, for lack of a better word, that each one has its own character. And now it's a thing, right? Or that people are very excited when distilleries are using pot. Like, I mean, this is in rum that I know, like Jamaican pot still is a thing. But
definitely very, very funky.
But it's also more work for, it's a more expensive product because you can only do this one batch. This one recipe, and then you have to start over with a different beer.
There are values to both. I mean, Irish whiskey at one point was the most popular whiskey in the world, and that was probably due to the fact that they used column stills, so they were able to produce more whiskey and produce it cheaply, and thus disseminate it around the world easily.
But according to in the early 19th century. Irish whiskey loses a lot of market share to Scotch, and that is partly because they don't want to use the distillate that is created from column stills, because there's what they refer to it as silent spirit, which was low cost grain alcohol, which would be made from a column still. And they even fight this Spirits Act that's passed in the 1860s in Great Britain that allows column still grain whiskey to be called whiskey. And the folks from Jameson and Let's see. Well, it just says the four Dublin distillers publish a book called The Truths About Whiskey, and they lay out the case that whiskey that contained grain alcohol from a coffee still did not constitute real whiskey and should not be labeled as such. But they
Isn't that funny?
They lose.
Yeah.
And that's like, so that's 1908. And the Royal Commission, so they're all still part of Great Britain, which is also key, right? The Royal Commission says that they, that right, pot whiskey could, pot still whiskey, not pot whiskey, which is probably going to be a thing that we'll all be drinking at some point, right?
Probably pot, here in Seattle.
Pot still whiskey can be blended with grain whiskey. And so that is like step one. To, and it's so interesting because it's an Irishman that creates the coffee still. And then
Wouldn't be the first time nor the last time that the Irishman is responsible for the downfall of his own people.
Right.
It's kind of their way.
Yes, yes. Then they get what they wanted, which was independence, well, mostly. But it also means that they lose this market of England and Scotland, because now there are tariffs, right, in importing and exporting. It's not like you're just sending it to another part of your empire. And in fact, the new Irish government looks upon a lot of the distillers as like Northern Irish Protestant activity. And they begin to limit the amount of whiskey that could be exported. And all of that dovetails with prohibition in the United States.
Oh, my God. And keep taking all, punches.
And all of the... So they can't legally sell their Irish whiskey. And all of the Scottish distillers see a real opportunity to sneak in Scotch and the
Scotchmen,
Irish.
They're sneaky. The Scotsmen, they're sneaky. They're crafty.
I believe canny and cunning are the adjectives that keep coming up, which are. But Abigail, here's the other thing that I thought was really interesting: is the Scots take over? They don't take over, but they begin to take over. Yeah. Control every aspect of from distilling to bottling to distribution. Mm-hmm. And the Irish distillers are still sending out their Irish whiskey in barrels to other people to bottle it, where it is often adulterated. And so in America, Scotch begins to be seen as a product that you can count on because it's coming in the bottle from the distiller. And Irish whiskey, Who knows what's going to be in that bottle? And all of that leads to, all right, I don't like to read lots of statistics, but I thought that this one was really interesting. By the 1980s, it had hit rock bottom. I thought I had a number. It was like there were only 200,000 gallons of Irish whiskey left, like by
Are
the
you
1960s.
Kidding me?
It's like
Are
crazy.
Are you kidding me?
Hold on.
I get sick to my stomach just thinking about all that Irish whiskey lost. I get so sad. I read about this the first time on a plane, and I was listening to, you know, Elliot Smith, and so I was already kind of sad, and then you're on your plane, and everything's heightened, and I just started sobbing uncontrollably, and the sweet, kind stranger on the plane next to me was like, "Are you okay?" And all I could do was spit out, "All that Irish whiskey was just gone, and I'm so sad about it." So, if you're listening, kind stranger, I have recovered. I'm okay, but I still get really, really sad thinking about it. The combination of this losing that petition, and then the Irish independence, and then the ensuing Irish Civil War, and then just the general non-function of the Irish government to support Irish distillers in the early part of the 20th century just breaks my heart. And I tell you, I've There are towns in Ireland, in complete towns, that were based mm-hmm. on the fact that they had a distillery there. That town ran because of one distillery. And when that distillery closed, the whole town just disappeared, just vanished. And it was so, you know, when I traveled in Ireland in the 80s and 90s, I saw still the aftermath of this, like, loss of industry for these people. And I was just so sad about it then, and I still get a little sad about it now. But
well, and this is an important point to make, which is something that will come up again when we talk about when we talk about American whiskey during Prohibition, is that people forget this is, you know, people interact with alcohol who aren't working with mm-hmm. it and in it, as this, you know, this thing that is pleasurable, gives them joy. Perhaps if there's too much, then it gives you a hangover. But it is an industry, and it is the source of employment for tens of thousands of people. And that when you take that away, then you need to have something else set up in place for people to have a job. And it isn't only the people who are making the liquor, right? You have all of the industries that are supplying, giving all the materials necessary mm-hmm. to whether it's the grain or the bottles or the labels. I'm married to a graphic designer. Somebody has to make a label, you know, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff that we just forget. So fortunately, things turn around in the 1980s, 90s, and you have big companies like Diageo and Bacardi and Pernod Ricard getting into the business of making Irish whiskey. And it's so crazy how quickly things changed, and that this industry not only recovered, but it's, I mean, the numbers are, hold on, I'm going to find one that can just say it's like, it grew 300% in, yeah, there we go. Which Irish whiskey exports grew by 300% in the last 10 years.
That's crazy.
They had 5.2 million bottles in 2002, 45.6 million bottles in 2015.
I visited the Middleton Distillery where Jameson is made about 5 years ago, and they were in the process of installing new stills that would double their production. So as they are by far the largest facility for Irish whiskey, and they are now doubling production to try to meet demand.
What do you think about now there's all these other brands, not, you know, we all have heard of Jameson and Bushmill. Mm-hmm. I feel like those are the two big ones that most Americans have heard of.
Bushmills was actually too small to even be bothered with. It's the reason why it survived the great cull of Irish whiskeys, is that their production was so small, and they are still doing, you know, just single malt production. They're just doing single malt production. So even their blend, they truck up distillate from Middleton. So there was like a thing when I was in college where people were like, don't drink Bushmills, that's the Protestant Northern Irish whiskey. And I'm like, you know, it still has Southern Republic Irish whiskey in it. It's fine. That's not a thing.
Also, it is the oldest distillery in the world.
It is. 1609 or 1608, I believe, it was applied for its charter.
Yes.
And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I'm blessed to have been to a lot of these distilleries in Ireland. And one of the ones that is brand new, that is, but is based on an older brand, Tullamore. That's a town that I went through in the 80s that was very sad because it had lost its distillery. Well, William Grant and Sons has brought it back, and they have built a distillery that is going to be there in 100 years. It is gorgeous. It is a beautiful, beautiful distillery. They're pumping out as much distillate as they can. They're doing really interesting things with aging it. And they have beautiful rick houses for aging their barrels. And they've brought that town back. That town is so happy to have them there. And it's, you know, Tullamore is kind of like the Kansas of Ireland. It's right smack dab in the middle. And Tullamore was always just famous for one thing. It's whiskey. And I'm glad that they finally have their own whiskey that's going to be rolling out again soon.
Well, we cannot be remiss in only talking about the beautiful distilleries of Ireland. And we also have to talk about the beautiful distilleries of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And that the same thing that happens in Ireland does happen to Scottish distilleries. Some of them close because they don't really jump on the bandwagon of blending their whiskey and creating what some might describe as a more palatable, softer, approachable flavor. And they either stay open by selling their whiskey to be blended with something else, like Lagavulin, which I learned when I went to Isla, or they close. And it's why the Scotch that survives, that it flourishes really during starting in Prohibition and over time, are names like Dewar's and Johnny Walker, which are blended whiskeys. And well, not all of their products are right anymore, but they start out that way.
Oh yeah. Oh no, I think they're all blended. They're all considered blends.
And that flavor profile, which I personally don't like, that's not my favorite kind of Scotch, but I can see why that's what appeals to especially Americans who would have been used to whiskey, American whiskey, like bourbon. And also the Scots hop in during the phylloxera epidemic and they are sending their whiskey to France when the French can't get brandy. And surprise, surprise, France is the biggest importer of Scotch in the world. I didn't know that, huh? Mm-hmm. I bet they don't like that fact getting out. Like, we only drink brandy and cognac and Armagnac. But yeah, I think that there's this kind of looking at the palate of the world, or maybe not the whole world, but certainly a big drinking part of the drinking world in the United States, allows you to kind of see the ebb and flow of what Scotch whiskeys are successful. Because now, and I mean, that's still true, right? Like there's more people are drinking Dewar's than they are Laphroaig.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And more people are drinking Jameson than they are Kilbeggan 18. You know, the Jameson blend actually was created to appeal to American palates. They were like, we're not going to waste our time trying to pitch like five different Irish whiskeys to America. We're going to make one blend that we're going to throw all our kind of heart and soul into and all our marketing info into, and we're going to tailor it to the American palate. So Jameson is the number one selling Irish whiskey in America. It was designed to be that. They were very smart.
They are very smart. Oh, but speaking of blend, I want to make sure that everybody who's listening to this understands what that means, and also what makes Scotch and Irish whiskey. So when we use the words, the term single malt, that means that it is only malted barley. So that's the primary grain. When we think of Scotch or Irish whiskey. And also it is made at a single distillery. Scotch and Irish whiskey both have to be aged at least 3 years in wooden barrels. Mm-hmm. But then if you have something blended, then it can come not only from multiple grains, but it can be from multiple distilleries.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, a lot of Scotch blends come from different distilleries. It's a lot of single malts kind of blended together.
And that's how For example, Lagavulin, which is a premium single malt scotch, when nobody wanted it in the 1970s, it was sending its product to be blended with other scotches and grain alcohol too, right? Yeah,
yes.
Like distillate.
There's often grain alcohol distillate in those blends.
So
not always, but a lot of times there is.
I am not a person that sticks with one brand, like my mother. My mother drinks Jack Daniels, mm-hmm. period, the mm-hmm. end. And I tend to drink around, especially if I'm out, and then it's easy to like do a flight of things or, you know, have a sample of something. But I don't necessarily pay attention to what's going into all of my whiskeys. And what are your thoughts about, like, for the people who really get into who's mixing what? Like, what makes my Johnny Walker Johnny Walker, and where's it coming from? Or
I find that when people like a blend, they like it because it's smooth. That's what they say. It's smooth. And and I don't think they realize what makes it smooth. I see a lot of eyes get wide. I have a Scotch cocktail on the menu called Paris Between the Wars. And I've used a lot of different blends, you know, trying to figure out what tastes the best. And I really have preferred, there's a company called Compass Box that makes beautiful blends from all single malt scotches. And mm-hmm. their Glasgow blend in particular has a higher proportion of kind of smoky mm-hmm. peaty scotches, and also scotches that have been finished in sherry casks. So you get a nice peaty sherry mm-hmm. note to the blend, and it stands up well in this cocktail. And when I tell people that I know, because they're kind of open about it. They're very much like, if you go to their website, they're like, this blend is this much Lagavulin and this much that and this much Talisker. Mm-hmm. And like, they tell you exactly where they get their distillate from. Most people are really secretive about it, so they don't talk about it. And there are a whole group of people that love to kind of like guess, like, oh, this black bottle tastes so good. I know it has some Bunahavan in it, you know? I think it's really, you know, and then also people, if you do like follow the money and follow the paper trail, you could figure out exactly which distillery is providing to which blend. But the amounts, the exact amounts, you'll never really know. Sometimes it's a complete and utter secret. It's only a company that Compass Box that is like so proud of the work they do in the blending that they're like, yeah, we'll tell exactly how we did this and how we built this. So yeah, there is a group of people who love to nerd out about blends and where it comes from, but the vast majority of blend drinkers probably don't even realize that.
It makes me think of an article I read about, it was an interview with, it was at least one, maybe two bartenders, and they were trying to figure out who was supplying the liquor to Costco, to Costco's, the Kirkland brands.
Yes.
And it's like, this reminds me of, and you know, who do I think it is? So I can see how that could be funny or fun. I can see how that could be fun, especially if you are like, so well-versed in your spirits, especially if like you're a bartender, you're tasting things all the time. And there reaches a point where you're just like, yeah, this is Talisker. This is definitely Talisker, you know, or whatever. Speaking of Talisker, Lee and I took a belated honeymoon, and we drank our way across Scotland. Well, part of it, I mean, and we rested too. We drank, and then we climbed mountains, and then we drank some more. But anyway, we went to Talisker on the Isle of Skye, and everybody should go to Skye. Skye's really beautiful. But one of my favorite memories is like, we think, because Talisker isn't unreasonably expensive, but it is Scotch, single malt Scotch can be pretty pricey, compared to, you know, an American whiskey or rum. And so I think that they acquire a certain reverence, right? People are like, oh, yes. I have my single malt Scotch. And there's one really great inn/inn/ restaurant that's near Talisker. And when we went to have lunch, all along the back of the bar. There are speed pours. And for those of you that don't know, a speed pour is a bottle that's turned upside down into this, what do you call it? The it's like how you get a Coke out of a, like when
it's
you
like
get a fountain
Coke. It's a pre-measured pour spout that, you know, the bottles are just placed in upside down. So you could just put a glass underneath it and pop it up and get your exact amount of perfectly measured whiskey.
And you do that because you are serving that product all the time. And so in, you might have a speed pour in like a club in America that is, and you'd put your wells back there, right? Or speed pours usually wells, or it seems to me that it, you're having like the less, the you're putting in a speed pour, a product that moves a lot, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. But at this inn, all the speed pours were Talisker. all of the Taliskers were lined up. And I was like, is this the only thing we can order here? And of course they had other products on offer, but it was clear that they had figured out very early on.
That is my favorite thing about visiting Scotland is going into a Scottish pub and just seeing walls of beautiful, beautiful whiskey. Yeah. They have so much whiskey. I don't even know what they do with it all. Yes, there's a lot of whiskey, and it all tastes so different. You know, we all know the different regions. There's Speyside and Highland and Lowland and Isla and Orkney. There's all it's a vast country, and their distilleries are spread out all over. Where Elizabeth and Lee went, Talisker is actually kind of hard to get to. It's a bit of a hike, but as they said, so worth it. If you're looking for bang for your buck, Isla is the island where all the smoky, peaty scotches come from, and there's about 9 distilleries on that one small island, so you could hit a lot there. 3 of them you could just stumble from the ferry.
Yes.
You get off the ferry and you could just walk up the road to Ardbeg, Laphroaig, and Lagavulin. Although these are all such well-established distilleries now that you go in and they're mostly... It's mostly like, here, take the tour, see the history, you know, we'll roll out the ceremonial barrel, you could pull out a dram, and then you go. But if you actually go and watch their production, they are just filling up tankers full of distillate, just pumping it out, having computers pumping it out, filling up tankers, sending those tankers back on the ferry, and they're actually aged on the mainland and bottled there.
Right.
There's only, I think, one distillery on the island that actually does all their aging and bottling on the island as well. And that's Brooklady. And I think they have another small distillery that just started that is probably doing the same since I've last been there. But that's the case with a lot of these Scottish distilleries. They've got this big name and they're just pumping out distillate and sending it out. And it's very rare to find someone doing it all from soup to nuts, as it were.
Right, because the commercial scale is, I mean, everybody's just clamoring for more and
it's
more
immense.
Of this. And
it's immense, yeah.
But one thing that you can do if you go to Isla, and Isla's, as you say, Isla's efficient because it's small and everything's there, but you better like peaty scotch, right? So if you don't, go somewhere else. but one thing that you can do with Laphroaig is you can dig peat. And that's something we haven't talked about. P-E-A-T is an organic... it's like dirt. It's not clay and it's not grass, but it is this compacted organic material.
It's kind of like pre-coal.
Yes. That has formed over tens of thousands of years. And for a very long time, it was a source of, it was your heating in Scotland if you, and in Ireland too, although the peat in Ireland is different than the peat in Scotland, so they say.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus it's the production is completely different. The Irish don't really use peat in their whiskey.
Right. But I was reading that some brands are considering, you know, having like a special peated whiskey in response to how popular Scottish peated whiskey can be. Mm-hmm. That it's, you know, kind of having like doing a special, what is that called when you do like
a special limited run edition?
Yes, a special limited run. But anyway, okay. So they're considering doing a special limited run to peat their Irish whiskey. But that is a thing that is already done with several scotches, particularly those on Islay, which is why one of the activities that you can do is to go dig peat. And this involves going out onto the bog, and Lee even joked, he called it Tom Sawyering. And for those of you that didn't have to read this in middle school, Tom Sawyer is very, he has to paint a fence and he convinces all of his friends that it's a privilege to be able to paint this fence, and they pay him for the privilege of painting the fence. So we paid Lefroig for the privilege of going out and digging peat. But after we dug a little bit, Lee was like, this is really fun and I'd keep doing it. And I was like, right. But also we got to drink whiskey while we were digging the peat, which I'm pretty sure that all the peat diggers who had to do this like for all the distilleries, they probably drank whiskey while they were out there too. But it's this interesting spade that is an L shape. And so rather than just a flat shovel, it's an L, and you stick it in the peat and it goes really deep, and then you kind of angle it and then you pull it out, and then you've made a brick of peat, which in the B&B where we were staying in Islay, there was a fire and they had peat, bricks of peat. That's burn.
My Irish grandmother, she kept her house warm. She had no central heating in her house. She had one small stove in her kitchen, and she burned blocks of peat to keep warm.
I wish I had known your Irish grandmother, because we could not get that fire lit, and it was smoky. And we like filled our living room with smoke, and then because I was like, oh, won't this be cozy and charming? And let's burn the peat and see what it smells like, and it'll smell like whiskey, and it didn't.
They actually in Dublin at the convenience stores, like at the 7-Eleven, the Spa store, as it was called in Dublin, the Spa, you can buy blocks of compressed peat because people still use that to kind of heat their homes. And I once on a trip came home in a backpack with my backpack full of this compressed peat and gave it to my parents. And every year for Christmas, they would burn one block from Ireland.
That's nice. As a little
kind of nod to the old country. So, but yeah, this was definitely pre 9/11 days. I can't imagine. I walked onto a plane with a whole bunch of compressed peat.
With a something that's flammable. Yeah. Right.
I mean, it's very safe.
I guess everything is flammable, but you have to have match or something.
But that's the main difference between like the taste difference between Scotch and Irish whiskey, is that there are like Connemara is a brand of Irish whiskey that does use peat, and it tastes just like Scotch. And I'll kind of throw it in blind tastings just to kind of throw everyone off the scent, because they immediately assume it's a Scotch. And I'm like, it would be if it was made in Scotland, but it's not, it's Irish. So the only difference between that is the Irish grain and the Irish water that they use to make it, and the Irish peat, of course. But yes, traditionally, when the malting process is, you have this grain, this barley. It's just a grain of barley, and you have to malt it. And in order to malt it, what you do is you let it germinate and grow. And a little kind of green sprout comes out the end of the grain. And when it's about the size of the grain, the sprout is the size of the grain, they halt the malting process. And to do that, you have to expose it to heat. And the way they do it in Scotland is they pour all the maltings onto this ceramic floor that has these tiny holes in it. And underneath that floor, they have an oven where they stoke it with peat. And depending on how long they burn it and how intense the peat is, they actually measure the BPMs for how smoky that malting is going to be. Now, in Ireland, they have the same process. They use the malt, they do the malting, but they stop that germination process with the same thing. They put it into a room with ceramic holes in it, but then underneath, instead of an oven where they're burning peat, it's just an oven with hot air. So they stop the malting process with hot air. They stop the growth, and then that gives it just a toasted malt flavor and not a toasted smoked malt flavor.
Right. And depending on the product, some are super, super smoky. And then some have just a very, very light, subtle smokiness to them. And so this is a nice segue into, there's somebody who says this for almost every spirit. Oh, I don't like fill in the blank of spirit. And there's such... And there are people who say, oh, I don't like scotch. And there's such variety out there that it makes me wonder, what have you had? And unless you've tried several really different scotches, and then maybe you can say that. So if you were going to have somebody do a flight, let's say four, right? And after four, your palate's kind of tired. So to give a real overview, we'll do scotch and then we'll do Irish whiskey.
Okay. So for scotch whiskey, you want to start kind of on the mellow, do you want to include blends?
Sure. Right. Yeah. Or should we do blends separate? No, right. Let's keep it simple.
Okay,
right.
Keep it simple. Okay. So, right away, we're going to start with a blend from Compass Box. And we're going to start with one of my favorite kind of styles of Scotch whiskey, which is one that has a nice sherry cask influence. I love, you know, most of Scotches start off their life in a bourbon barrel, but a lot of them get finished in sherry casks. And that adds such beautiful nutty flavor and really makes, to me, my favorite part of Scotch whiskey. So we're going to introduce you to a blend first, and that's the Flaming Heart. From Compass Box, and it has a subtle sherry cask influence that really adds this beautiful richness, and it's kind of delicious to enjoy neat. It's also delicious with like a after-dinner cheese plate. You know, that's how I would enjoy that. The next one, well, my favorite everyday drink in Scotch, single malt. I discovered this one through rigorous tasting in a pub in Glasgow, thanks to my friend Gordon, who works for Whiskey Magazine. I'm like Whiskey Magazine.
Sure, right. Oh, but Whiskey Magazine.
I am not a fan of the super smoky scotches, so I wanted to find my everyday drinking scotch. So he put a whole bunch in front of me and I tasted through them. And the one I picked out as my favorite was Scapa 16, 16-year-old single malt scotch from the Orkney Islands, the northernmost distillery in Scotland. It's right up there next to Highland Park. So
pretty north. It's practically Norway.
Yes, it's very near the Arctic Circle, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, in fact,
which is amazing.
For a while, Orkney was controlled by Norway.
Okay, so the next one I would choose would, speaking of interesting finishes to whiskey, the next one I'd throw in there would be a Glenmorangie Nectar d'Or. Glenmorangie does a lot of really nice, they do a port finish, a Madeira finish. They all do all these special barrel finishes to their whiskey. The Nectar d'Or I like to carry for people who think they don't like scotch because it's really soft and subtle and it's finished in Sauterne casks. So you've got a nice kind of French wine influence to this particular scotch. And it is really, really pretty and soft and I think it'd be the one I would suggest for people who think they don't like scotch to give that one a try. And then, of course, we have to end with a peat balm. So that's going to be, although Talisker makes a gorgeous version called Talisker Storm that is very peaty. We have to go with an Islay scotch, and there's so many to choose from. But my personal favorite is Ardbeg. Ardbeg is kind of like the punk rock young startup, because it like started in the 1800s compared to like Lagavulin and Lafroig. And Ardbeg has real salty salinity and brininess to its smoky scotch, along with that punch of kind of Band-Aid. People say, oh, it tastes like Band-Aids. Yeah, that's exactly what it tastes like. And it is really, really good. They come out with all these special expressions every year that have different finishes, and they're doing radical things with barrel finishes. And I don't know, I prefer that kind of salty seaweed quality of the Ardbeg. Plus their mascot is this really cute Jack Russell dog. So how can I not love, having two kind of terriers myself, how can I not love me some Ardbeg?
All right. And then for Irish whiskey, what would you tell people to do?
Irish whiskey, yeah, you're going to have to try a couple different distilleries. Now, right now, a lot of different styles of whiskey are all coming out of Middleton. You kind of have to look very hard to find a brand that does not have some sort of Middleton distillate in it. So for sure, go up north to Bushmills and get their single malt. I like their 16-year-old single malt. Make sure it's not one of the blends. If it's single malt, then it's all it will be all Bushmills. They also use a lot of sherry casks, so I do like the older variations of the Bushmills whiskey, because that will have more sherry, more time in sherry barrels, and it's really gorgeous. Then I think for your Middleton selection, you know, everyone knows Jameson, but I'm a big fan of Powers, John Powers brand. Powers, Paddy's, and Jameson actually were all three separate Irish whiskeys that joined to be one. And when they did, on the bottle of Powers, they put three swallows. And those three swallows represented those three brands kind of coming together as one. So Powers Gold Label is kind of like the kind of really basic level, and it's got a little bit more funk. It's a little bit more chewy than Jameson. I think it has a higher proponent of pot still malt. Jameson is a blend of malted barley, unmalted barley, and corn, and the corn makes it a little sweeter. I think Powers has a little bit more of that single pot still malted barley, because it's just got a little bit more meatiness to it, and unctuousness to it, that I really, really like. Then, yeah, I'd say, again, throw that Connemara in the mix. The only that I know of peated Irish whiskey. So it's going to taste a lot like a scotch, but it's softer. It's got that softer Irish water. It's got that Irish grain, and it's not overly peated. So it's, while it's very, very smoky, it's a different kind of smoke. And then again, just finish it up with interesting cask finishes, with the Irish are now doing as well. Tullamore Dew has two cask finishes that I really like. They have a Caribbean barrel that is finished in a Caribbean rum barrel, and they have a cider cask finish that is finished in Irish, French cider casks. And that really, particularly the cider cask, now that I'm in Washington State, that's the Tullamore Dew we carry and support at the bar, the cider cask finish, because how do you like them Washington apples? Little Irish whiskey and apples. If you'd like a list of Scotch whiskeys and Irish whiskeys you can try, we're going to put that up on the website. I'm going to write it out and explain to you why I have chosen each Irish and Scotch whiskey for you to try out and enjoy, to taste the range of flavors these beautiful whiskeys have to offer.
Yes, and Abigail actually referred to the Drink and Learn website is going to be improving considerably, with a whole section designated for the podcast, and we'll be able to list recipes and links and all that kind of information. In the meantime, before that goes live, I can also post it on the Drink and Learn Facebook page. So it will live there. And I mean, as we all know, the thing about Facebook is that you have to scroll down once other things are posted. But in the meantime, we can put all that there as well. And speaking of recipes, I think it's time for an old world whiskey cocktail recipe. What are we going to be drinking?
There's not a lot of classic cocktails that use Irish and Scotch whiskey, and a lot of them are kind of variations of a Manhattan, such as a Rob Roy, a Bobby Burns, or the Tipperary. So I have really taken it upon myself to create lots of cocktails using these fine spirits. And I've had a lot of success with them in competitions as well. Drinks like the Paris Between the Wars and the Charlie Hustle. But today we're going to be talking about a drink called the Chin Music. Chin Music is an Irish whiskey drink that uses also some dry vermouth and lemon juice and ginger liqueur, because as any bartender who was on the Jameson trip with me knows, little side note, whiskey and ginger is totally a thing, as if you didn't know from going into any bar and seeing people order whiskey and ginger. But it's a wonderful kind of pairing, that ginger with the sweetness and the nuttiness of Irish whiskey. Okay. As you listeners to the podcast might remember, I am a huge baseball fan, and I have a whole bunch of drinks named after baseball terms, and Chin Music is one of them. Chin Music is what happens when a pitcher throws really high and tight on the inside of a batter, just nicking his chin, really, kind of pushing him off the plate, and they call that throwing some chin music. So we're going to throw some chin music your way start with your shaker full of ice. This is a citrus drink, so get that fresh lemon out and squeeze about one lemon's worth, so you can get about 3/4 of an ounce of fresh juice. And we're going to throw that in the shaker with some ice. And then we're going to throw a whole ounce of dry vermouth in here. This is another like great way to run through that small bottle of vermouth that you have bought for martinis. And maybe you're drinking some vermouth on the rocks, but you still have some vermouth left. So go ahead and whip this drink together with a full ounce of dry vermouth. And then we're going to use a whole ounce of Irish whiskey, the Irish whiskey of your choice. I'm not going to play favorites here. They're all delicious. See what you got in your cupboard. I happen to have an Irish whiskey that's imported and then bottled in New Orleans called Irish Channel Irish Whiskey. So we're going to use a little bit of that. 1 ounce of that. Then we're going to use 3/4 of an ounce of ginger syrup. I'm using Domaine de Canton. It's got a nice little sweetness to it and a subtle ginger quality. But there's lots of ginger liqueurs out there. There's one I found locally here called New Deal that's delicious as well. So 3/4 of an ounce of ginger. And then I think we've got everything together. Make sure, put the top on. Give that a little shake. And you're going to pour that into a chilled cocktail glass. And then you're just going to garnish that with a sprig of fresh thyme. Little thyme has historically represented courage, and boy, have the Irish people needed some courage these last 500 years of oppression, and courage this last 100 years seeing the fall of the Irish whiskey industry.
But then it came
it's coming
back.
Right back. So let's toast to the chin music. It was a close call, but we survived, Irish whiskey.
Right.
So cheers to you and some chin music.
Yeah, it did not strike out. continuing with all the baseball. You know, Lee says he one of the things that he can't stand about listening to baseball radio broadcasts is because every advertiser feels an obligation to shoehorn some kind of baseball lingo into all their ads, even if it has nothing to do with whatever it, they're, you know, it's like, don't strike out on health insurance, you know, or whatever. Like, batter up to your grocery store.
I hope we haven't done the same. Have Lee listen to this and make sure he approves.
I'm sure he will, of course. So that that does it for Scotch and Irish Whiskey, which we covered in less than an hour.
That can't be possible. We clearly have left so much out.
But like this, what this is meant to do, of course, is to encourage you to go armed with a little bit of knowledge, which I don't think is a dangerous thing. It should just encourage you to go get more knowledge.
And I would hope it would encourage you to go to the bar and try maybe a new whiskey you haven't tried before and have your bartender tell you a little bit about it and why they stocked it and why they like it.
Right. And if they can't, then you should go to a different bar because your bartender should be able to answer those two questions.
And well, you could come to my bar, Ben Paris, because it's open now.
Yeah, I was going to say, unless your bartender says something like the owner made us stock it, which is its own separate kind of answer. But yeah, so go see Abigail at Ben Paris and go see
Elizabeth in New Orleans, drink and learn, go get a tour.
Yes. And you can also buy my book and pretend that you're in New Orleans and listen to us and pretend that you are sitting at the bar with us. That's, you know what? I think for from now, I like the idea, even though this probably is not how most people consume the podcasts. I know most people are listening to it on a commute or maybe on their morning walk or something like that. But I really like the idea of somebody fixing a drink and then just sitting down and drinking it and listening to us and maybe making the drink from the episode before and then listening or something. I don't know. And then it's like you're drinking with us, kind of, instead of drinking with us on your commute.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I'm going to go have some drinks now. This is like my first half day off in 2 weeks. I'm going to go watch a baseball game and get some drinks. There will probably be whiskey involved.
That sounds good. I hope you sneak a flask in the stadium on principle.
Oh my God. I'm going to totally do that now just because you said, nobody tell on me, okay? This is just between us.
I won't. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And
thank you so much, everyone, for listening.
Come back soon. Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.